A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about airports again. Not as a place you rush through, but as a place you stay. He says there's something weirdly liberating about airport terminals. This sense that nobody knows you. You can just exist. The problem is the layover pressure. The vigilance. The gate timer. The thing that spoils the overpriced beer. And he's wondering, what if you could just not leave? What if you could craft a leisurely path around the world, hopping from one airside hotel to the next, never actually entering any country, just living in the international transit system?
Right, and he's connecting it back to that hotel episode, the one about how hotels have protocols to periodically eject guests so nobody can claim primary habitation. He's asking whether airports have the same thing, and whether there are airside hotels you can push beyond a few hours. Plus the blimp episode's conclusion, that when travel got fast and budget-driven, it stopped being luxurious and started being harried. So the question is, can you invert that? Make the stops the destination?
Three questions, really. One, what airports allow overnight transit stays? And are there airside hotels that permit longer blocks? Two, could you actually plot a leisurely round-the-world itinerary entirely within the international airport system? And three, this is the one I keep coming back to. Does the liberating feeling survive the attempt to make it permanent?
Let's start with the hard mechanics, because the answer to, can you live airside, is mostly no, and the reasons are genuinely fascinating.
Mostly, no is the best kind of no.
Airports are designed as throughput machines. Every square meter, the moving walkways, the gate seating, even the lounges, is optimized to move people through, not keep them. And the legal architecture reinforces this. Airports are legally ports, not cities. They exist in a jurisdictional gray zone where you haven't entered the country, but you're not exactly in international waters either.
The transit visa regime. That's the invisible cage.
Most countries cap transit stays at 24 to 96 hours, depending on the country and your passport. Even visa-free transit zones, where you don't need a visa to connect through, require you to hold an onward ticket within a specific window. Usually 24 hours, sometimes 48, rarely more than 72. And the airline checks this before you even board the first flight.
Because if they fly you somewhere and you get denied entry, they're on the hook for flying you back.
So the constraint starts before you leave. But let's talk about the airside hotels themselves, because this is where it gets specific. Singapore Changi has the Aerotel, which is airside. You never clear immigration. It's inside the sterile zone. The booking system caps stays at 24 hours. You can book a block, but you can't book a week.
And if you try to book consecutive blocks?
There are documented cases of people stretching it by booking back-to-back 24-hour blocks. But Changi's own rules cap total transit time at 48 hours. After that, you're in violation of the transit visa conditions, and the airport is legally obligated to address that.
Address that? That's a very diplomatic way of saying security escorts you to a departure gate.
Dubai International is even tighter. The airside hotel there, the Dubai International Hotel, operates on blocks as short as 4 hours, and the booking system maxes out at 12-hour blocks. You can't even book a full day. Doha Hamad has the Oryx Airport Hotel, same deal. Short stay blocks, typically 4 to 8 hours, and the system won't let you string together more than 24 hours total.
So the hotels themselves are the enforcement mechanism. It's not that a manager shows up and knocks on your door. The software literally won't let you book beyond the cap.
And that's the deeper mechanism Daniel's really asking about. It's the same logic as the hotel episode. Airports are legally obligated to prevent what's called de facto immigration. If you could stay airside indefinitely, you could effectively live in a country without ever formally entering it. And that creates a nightmare of legal liability, asylum claims, the whole edifice of border sovereignty starts to wobble.
The hotel ejects you, so you can't claim tenancy. The airport ejects you, so you can't claim existence.
And the enforcement is stricter because there's no primary habitation. claim to worry about. The risk is purely an asylum claim or a statelessness claim. If someone can demonstrate they've been living in an airport for 6 months, that becomes a diplomatic incident. Countries really, really don't want that.
So, the practical ceiling at any major hub is 48 hours. Maybe 96 if you've got a favorable passport and a generous transit visa regime. But what about the workaround? The thing where you fly out and back in?
The flagpole technique. You fly to a nearby country, land, and immediately turn around and fly back. It resets the transit clock because you've technically departed and re-entered the transit zone. But, and this is the part that kills the fantasy, it requires leaving the sterile zone. You have to clear immigration in the intermediate country even if only for an hour, and that defeats the whole premise of never leaving the international airport system.
You've touched ground. You've entered a country. The spell is broken.
There's one genuine exception worth mentioning, and it's not at a hub. There are a handful of airports, mostly small regional ones, that don't have airside hotels at all, but do have designated sleeping areas where overnight stays are tolerated. The website sleepinginairports.net tracks this obsessively, but tolerated is the key word. You're sleeping on a bench, not checking into a room. And even then, security will eventually notice someone who's been there for 3 days.
The bench near the butterfly garden that nobody uses.
Which brings us to the second question, the itinerary. Could you actually plot a leisurely path around the world through transit hubs?
Let's assume you accept the 48-hour cap at each stop. You're not trying to live in the system permanently. You're trying to stretch a round-the-world trip into something unhurried, where the airports themselves are the experience.
The hub-hopping route. Here's what it looks like. You start in Singapore. Changi, the gold standard. 48 hours airside. You've got the butterfly garden, the rooftop pool, the movie theater, the aerotel for sleep. Then you fly to Doha, Hamad International. Another 48 hours. The Oryx Hotel, the giant teddy bear sculpture, the squash court.
There's a squash court airside.
There's a squash court airside. Then Dubai. 48 hours, though you'll have to work the 12-hour hotel blocks. Then Istanbul. The new airport has an airside hotel. The Yotel, same short-stay model, but you can push it. Then Helsinki, Vantaa, has airside sleeping pods and a hotel that permits overnight blocks. Then back to Singapore.
That's 5 stops, not 10.
If you want 10, you add Frankfurt, Zurich, Hong Kong, Incheon, and Narita. Each one has an airside hotel or transit hotel. Each one caps you at 24 to 48 hours. A 10-stop itinerary with 24-hour stays at each hub takes about 2 weeks and requires roughly 15 flights.
And the cost?
Astronomical. You're looking at $8,000 to $12,000 in airfare alone, plus hotel costs at each stop. Figure another $2,000 to $3,000 for the transit hotels. So, $10,000 to $15,000 total, minimum. For 2 weeks of living in airports.
For 2 weeks of living in airports.
But here's what's interesting. Daniel's framing this against the blimp episode's conclusion. That when travel got fast and budget-driven, it stopped being luxurious and became harried. The hub-hopping route inverts this completely. The flights themselves are 6 to 12 hours each, long haul, not budget. The stops are the destination. You're not rushing through Changi to make a connection. You're spending 2 days at Changi, deliberately, with time to use the pool and see the butterfly garden and eat at the hawker stalls.
The experience becomes the point. You're not in transit. Transit is the trip.
And that's luxurious in a way that first-class cabins can't replicate. A first-class seat is still a seat. 2 days at Changi with no obligations is...
But... The sensory reality. Let's talk about what these spaces actually feel like after 48 hours.
The aerotel at Changi is nice. It's clean, it's quiet, the beds are comfortable, but most of the rooms have no windows, no natural light. You're breathing recycled air. The ambient sound is a 24-hour fluorescent hum punctuated by gate announcements in 3 languages. After about 36 hours, you start to lose track of whether it's day or night, and not in a liberating way, in a disorienting way.
The thing Daniel's describing, that weird comfort, the liberation of being nobody in a transitory space, that's real. I've felt it. Everyone's felt it. But it's a feeling that depends on knowing it's temporary. The airport beer tastes good because you've got 2 hours until boarding. The anonymity feels freeing because you're about to go back to your life.
Stretch it to 48 hours and something shifts. The anonymity stops feeling freeing and starts feeling thin. You're not liberated from identity. You're just in a space that has no identity to offer you. It's sensory deprivation with a food court.
Which is the second order insight, I think. The reason we find airports comforting isn't the architecture or the amenities. It's the absence of obligation. No one expects anything of you in an airport. You have no history there. No relationships. No tasks. Except waiting. It's the only space in modern life where you can do nothing and feel zero guilt about it.
And that's precisely why it can never become home. The moment you try to make it permanent, obligations creep in. You need to eat regularly, not just when you're hungry between flights. You need to do laundry. You need somewhere to receive mail. The airport can't provide any of that, because providing it'd make the airport a city, and airports are legally prohibited from being cities.
So, the liberating feeling is parasitic on its own temporariness. You can stretch it to 48 hours, maybe 72 if you've got a generous visa window and a high tolerance for fluorescent lighting. But push beyond that and the thing you're chasing evaporates.
There's a clinical parallel here. I used to see this in pediatric wards, actually. Kids who were in the hospital for a day or two found it almost exciting. The novelty, the attention, the break from routine. Kids who were in for weeks, the novelty curdles. The fluorescent hum becomes oppressive. The lack of natural light starts affecting sleep cycles, mood. The space hasn't changed, but the relationship to it has.
The hospital isn't home and can't become home, and the attempt to make it home is what makes it unbearable.
And airports are the same. They're designed for throughput, not habitation, and the design works at a psychological level. You're not supposed to be there long enough to notice that the ceiling tiles don't quite line up, or that the same announcement loop plays every 11 minutes.
Every 11 minutes?
I timed it once at Ben Gurion. 11 minutes, 40 seconds. The same security reminder, the same gate change notice that never changes, the same plea to not leave baggage unattended. After 2 hours, it's background noise. After 48 hours, it's psychological warfare.
So the answer to Daniel's first question, are there airside hotels you can push beyond a few hours, is yes, but only to about 48 hours, and only at a handful of hubs. The answer to the second question, can you pot a leisurely round-the-world transit itinerary? Is yes, but it'll cost you $15,000 and 2 weeks of your life, and by day four you'll be having conversations with the departure board.
Which leaves the third question. Does the liberating feeling survive the attempt to make it permanent? And I think the answer is no, but the attempt itself is worth understanding.
Say more.
Daniel's not wrong to be drawn to this. The fantasy of living in an airport is a fantasy of shedding responsibility without shedding comfort. You want the air conditioning and the food court and the anonymity, but you don't want the mortgage and the commute and the social obligations. It's a very specific kind of utopianism, the airport as a post-obligation society.
The airport as a monastery, vows of poverty, silence, and not leaving the sterile zone.
And like a monastery, it works because it's structured. The rules are clear. You know exactly what's expected of you. Go to your gate, board your flight, leave. The comfort comes from the clarity of the script, not from the space itself.
So when you try to tear up the script and write your own, the comfort dissolves. You're not a passenger anymore. You're a problem. Security starts noticing you. The hotel booking system rejects you. The transit visa clock is ticking. The system was designed to eject you, and it will.
But, and this is where I think Daniel's instinct is actually right, the attempt is still worth making, at least once, in a limited way. A 48-hour layover at Changi, deliberate and planned, is an unusual experience. You're not rushing. You're not harried. You're inhabiting a space that almost everyone passes through and almost no one actually experiences.
The airport is destination. You said something like this before, about people choosing connections based on amenities.
And it's accelerating. Changi's jewel, the giant indoor waterfall, the forest, the shops, that's not a transit facility. That's a mall with an airport attached. Istanbul's new airport has a museum. Incheon has a cultural center. Airports are becoming cities in everything but legal status. And the legal status is the only thing holding the line.
Which is the open question, isn't it? As airports add gyms and cinemas and butterfly gardens and squash courts, as they become more habitable, does the line between transit and habitation start to blur? And what happens when someone finally tests it?
With biometric screening and automated border control, the transit visa regime might loosen. If the system knows exactly who you are and exactly where you're at all times, the argument for ejecting you after 48 hours gets weaker. The security concern diminishes. What's left is the purely legal concern, the asylum claim risk, the de facto immigration problem.
And that's a political problem, not a technical one. Countries could decide to allow extended airside stays if they wanted to. They don't want to because it creates a category of person who exists in a legal gray zone. Not a visitor, not a resident, not a citizen, just present.
The resident, the person who lives in the airport.
Hilbert's been making a face for the last 10 minutes.
11 days.
Sorry?
Singapore, Changi, 1998. I was there 11 days. Not by choice.
11 days, airside?
Passport mix-up. My passport got damaged. Coffee spill. The photo page was unreadable. And the Singaporean authorities wouldn't let me enter, but my onward ticket was for a flight that had already left. I'd missed it while arguing with immigration. So I was in this limbo where I couldn't enter Singapore, and I didn't have a flight out.
How did you eat?
The food court takes credit cards. I had a credit card.
Where did you sleep?
There's a bench near the butterfly garden. The old butterfly garden, not the new one. It's gone now. But that bench was tucked behind a pillar, and the janitorial staff didn't run the floor buffer past it until about 2 in the morning. You could get 4 hours before they reached you, then you moved to the prayer room until dawn.
And nobody noticed you?
Oh, they noticed. By day 3, the transit hotel staff knew my name. They couldn't let me check in. I didn't have a valid boarding pass for an onward flight, and the system wouldn't accept the booking without one. But they started bringing me extra pillows. Called me the resident.
The resident.
Day 5, one of the security officers brought me a toothbrush. Said his wife had bought a multipack. By day 8, I knew the janitorial schedule better than the janitors. Quiet hours were 2 to 4 a.m. That's when you could use the shower in the gym without anyone asking questions. The one thing I couldn't solve was laundry. I bought new clothes from the airside shops. Still have the receipt somewhere.
How did it end?
The Irish embassy got involved eventually. Issued an emergency passport. I flew to Dublin, stayed with my brother-in-law for a month. He's the one who got me into archery.
Do you miss it?
I think about that bench more than I should. It's weird. I wouldn't do it again. But I'm glad I did it once.
That's exactly the paradox we've been circling. The experience was transformative precisely because it was involuntary and finite. If you'd chosen to live at Changi for 11 days, it'd have felt like a stunt. Because it happened to you, it became...
It became mine. The airport was mine in a way it's not anyone else's. I knew which bathroom stall had the broken lock, which departure gate had the comfortable armrests, which shift of janitors would let you stay on the bench an extra 20 minutes. That kind of knowledge, you can't get it from a 48-hour layover.
You became the resident. The thing the system is designed to prevent, and it happened anyway, because the system is made of people, and people bring you pillows.
The toothbrush was the moment I knew I'd crossed over. You don't bring a toothbrush to someone who's leaving tomorrow.
Did you ever go back? To Changi, I mean.
Transited through it in 2003. The bench was gone. They'd remodeled. I stood where it used to be for about 5 minutes, then went to my gate. Felt like visiting a house you used to live in, except the house doesn't know you were ever there.
That's the thing about airports. They don't remember you.
No, but you remember them.
The airport as the last truly anonymous space. You can spend 11 days there and leave no trace. The bench gets remodeled, the janitorial staff rotates, the security officer retires. Within a year, there's no evidence you were ever there. And yet, you carry it.
Which is maybe the real answer to Daniel's question. You can't live in an airport, the system won't let you, and even if it did, the thing you're chasing would dissolve. But you can pass through it slowly enough that it leaves a mark. 48 hours at Changi, deliberate and unhurried, might be the closest you can get to Hilbert's 11 days without a passport disaster.
And the round-the-world transit itinerary. 10 stops, 2 weeks, $15,000. It's not living in airports. It's visiting them deeply the way you'd visit a city. You're not trying to stay, you're trying to see.
The airport is a place you go to, not a place you go through.
The butterfly garden at 2 in the morning. That's the part I'd recommend. Nobody's there. The butterflies are asleep, or whatever butterflies do, and you're just there, in a garden. Inside an airport, in the middle of the night. with no flight to catch.
That's an image.
It's a good bench. Or was.
The transitory made permanent, just for a moment. And then you leave.
The question of whether the line between transit and habitation blurs further as airports become more like cities, I think it will. Biometric screening, automated border control, the gradual erosion of the transit visa as a meaningful barrier. At some point, someone's going to test it deliberately. Not a passport mix-up, but a conscious choice. I'm going to live at Changi for a month and document the whole thing.
And they'll probably succeed, because the system isn't designed to handle someone who's doing it on purpose, with resources and a plan. The system is designed to handle the accidental stranding, the misconnection, the damaged passport. A deliberate resident is a category error.
And category errors are how systems change. Someone does the thing that wasn't supposed to be possible, and suddenly the rules have to account for it.
The resident. Not a passenger, not a refugee, not a visitor. Just present. Existing in the gap between jurisdictions, sustained by food courts and prayer rooms, and the kindness of security officers with multi-backs of toothbrushes.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, who apparently has lived an entire separate life we knew nothing about.
Find us at myweirdprompts.com or email the show at showmyweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.